Welcome to Talking Energy, the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
My name's Rob Gross. I'm the director of the UK Energy Research Centre. Joining me today is Dr. Doug Parr, Policy Director for Greenpeace, and Simon Sharp, who's Deputy Director of the COP unit in the UK government. So welcome to you both. What we're going to talk about this afternoon is what we might hope for, what the UK government is trying to achieve. It's the way that it's approached COP. And so I'm going to kick straight off with a question to Simon. So the COP presidency, so that's us, has set a number of campaign, what you're calling campaign themes, I think. One of those is around adaptation and resilience. There's nature-based solutions. Obviously, here at UKIRK, we're most interested in the energy element of all of that, so the clean energy. Could you just explain what do these themes mean and what's the UK hoping to achieve by taking this approach?
Yeah, sure, Rob. So if we want to reduce global emissions, as we need to avoid dangerous climate change, then there are very large chunks of the economy that we have to change. The power sector, transport, buildings, industry, agriculture and land use. Those are the areas where most of the greenhouse gas emissions come from. And each of those, they're not just parts of our national economy, they're parts of the global economy. And if we want to change them really quickly so that we're moving towards clean technologies and sustainable practices, then we think we can do that much more quickly if countries align their efforts, if they agree on what the pace of the transition is in any of these sectors, and if they actually align some of their policies and coordinate and help each other where they need to. So you mentioned UKIRK is especially interested in energy and has a lot of expertise in the power sector. Well, there, countries can really help each other with making the right policy reforms, structuring their electricity markets in a way that attracts investment into clean technologies. So that's the kind of thing countries can do together that helps everybody make faster progress.
So would you would it be fair to describe this as an example of UK soft power? So rather than just focusing on the hard detail of the negotiations and commitments and so on, the British government is trying to take a softer approach? Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes, I suppose you could say that. We've seen the job of the presidency in two parts. One is chairing the formal negotiations, and the other is using the convening power of the presidency to bring countries together and look at how they can work together to make faster progress. So in each of the power sector, road transport and land use, in each of those areas, if the right countries come together and align their efforts, we can make much faster progress. So we're trying to use our convening power there to its best effect.
Okay, that's really interesting. Doug, what's your perspective, or what would a Greenpeace view be on these themes and the way that the UK has gone about pursuing them?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the structure of this is right, in the sense that there is a formal negotiation going on which is about the Paris rulebook. So the Paris Agreement was the agreement that was struck between nations 6 years ago now. And there are some rules around how that agreement is to be implemented that have got to be finalised and agreed. And if, you know, I expect a lot of media coverage that people will read about this, will talk about those things, about the rules on transparency and carbon markets and so on. But the thing is, we are talking about stopping climate change, and a rule book for an agreement doesn't stop climate change. What stops climate change is the, you know, renewable energy instead of coal. It's electric vehicles running instead of petrol vehicles. So the thing that we need is to build some momentum around making these things actually happen. And for kind of historical structural reasons, it's going to be pretty difficult to get some of this agreed in formal texts of the traditional UNFCCC agreement. So I think it's quite right that the UK should be seeking to use that convening power to assemble groups of people, groups of nations, who really want to go quicker. And if they can go quicker, then you start that clean technology race where it really helps. So, for example, on cars, if you've got a set of countries, who are willing to go quicker on cars, you've got a defined market for the car makers. And they can say, okay, let's tool up to meet that market. Now, not every single issue is like that, but some of them are. And that's why it's valuable to be able to do that.
Hang on a minute. I'm not sure if I've got this entirely right. This sounds as if Greenpeace entirely endorses the approach that the British government have been taking to their campaign themes for the COP presidency. Did I hear you correctly, Doug?
I wouldn't say everything. I think the overall structure, though, of trying to build momentum around constituencies of willing nations is correct. I think we'd like to see some, you know, probably something more on renewables, for example. But you know, this set of issues, they are a very important one. You know, you can make progress on cars, you can make progress on coal, you can make progress on finance. Absolutely critical. So there is something to be said for that choice of metrics. And I mean, in the end, of course, it's also about what the final deliverables are as well. But I would emphasise, as a package, the way in which this structure is being attempted to separate out momentum to drive change from the slowest of the slow, which is what the formal negotiations look like, then I think that's got to be right at this point in time.
That's interesting. Okay, thank you. So Simon, I'm just going to come back to you, focusing in on some of the particulars of your campaign around clean energy. So what kinds of things are you hoping that this kind of coalition of the willing that Doug describes, what might we be hoping for them to sign up to?
Yeah, I think Doug described it very well. And so one of these coalitions of the willing that we actually started a few years ago, back in 2017, is called the Powering Past Coal Alliance. And it's a group committed to phasing out coal from power generation, which is one of the biggest sources of emissions there is. And that's been growing. It's been growing quite rapidly. And we think it now covers about a third of the coal plants in the OECD countries. And it's still growing. It's countries, states, cities, investors, utilities, all of them committing to phase out unabated coal in power generation by 2030. And so we've been continually building that through the last 2 years of our presidency. And at Glasgow, we hope to make clear how much that's grown. Even in the last couple of weeks, we'll be gathering new signatories. And at the same time, not all countries, many developing countries, not all of them are ready yet to commit to phasing out coal. But there's an increasing movement towards saying no new coal power. We shouldn't be building any coal plants from now on. That's the worst thing you can do for climate change. So we're hoping to bring together a coalition of countries that can make commitments aligned with each other, scaling up clean power, no new coal power, phasing out coal power for those that are ready to say that. And for the most coal-intensive economies, a commitment to make a just transition away from coal power, where they're supporting the workers and the communities in that transition. So that's all something we're working to bring together as a signal, a political signal of direction and pace. The other thing we're doing is trying to provide very practical help to countries in making their transition away from coal and towards clean power. And there we've created something we call the Energy Transition Council, which has brought together governments with international organizations with expertise in the power sector, like the International Energy Agency, and also the multilateral development banks, which are able to provide concessional finance. So you've got the politics, the technology, and the finance all around the table together. And that council has been having focused discussions with about 15 developing countries saying, how can we best help you in your energy transition? What support can we give you that we're not already giving? that would help you move faster. So that's been one of the highlights of our presidency, I think, just seeing how that dialogue has grown in trust and grown in strength. And we're seeing many, many more countries now talking about their willingness to cut back plans for coal plants, even retire early some of the coal plants they already have. Much more of that than we saw when we started out 2 years ago.
That's interesting. I'm gonna bring Doug in on that in a moment. But before I do, we've got a current context at the moment where the price of gas is seldom out of the headlines. In fact, it only went out of the headlines when there were queues in petrol stations. And as soon as those went away, the price of gas came back into the headlines. If we're powering past coal, you know, surely this conversation with some of these countries is rather a different one than it was a few months ago when gas was much less expensive. Are we shifting them from coal to gas? And if that's the case, you know, what are they saying about the gas price at the moment?
Well, yeah, it's certainly topical. And there's a wide range of views about gas. But I think what is shifting all the time is the economics in favor of renewables. They're on these really steep cost reduction curves. And every time we double global deployment of solar, its cost comes down by about another 20%. Every time we double global deployment of wind, its cost comes down by at least another 10% or so. And so both of those technologies are crossing the tipping point where they're cheaper than coal. And coal and gas power, the cost, it's very volatile, but on average, it hasn't really changed anything over the last century, and it's not going to. So the gap is only growing in favor of renewables. In the UK power system, the really interesting thing we've seen is offshore wind, where we really took a lead and deployed it when it was very expensive. And a lot of economists said that was a crazy thing to do. But when you create that market, you create the economies of scale, you bring down the costs. The cost fell by 70% in a decade, and we're now in a position where offshore wind power is becoming cheaper than gas. So it's great that we've done that. And as you see the gas prices going sky high, you just think, let's get some more offshore wind onto the system.
All right. Thank you. Doug, I'm hearing almost... Now, you were sounding as if Greenpeace agreeing with the UK government. Now the UK government sounding a bit like Greenpeace. What do you think about some of this stuff?
Well, I think there is value in, again, international cooperation on power systems because, I mean, broadly speaking, I would characterise the way the UK is going about this as going from coal to clean. Because the proportion of gas has more or less stayed the same and its role has shifted. But that's an important message that, in effect, you've had the flexibility of gas has allowed more and more renewables onto the system whilst eliminating coal. And now we're seeing other forms of flexibility that can start to take up the slack and squeeze out the gas. And I think that's a learning point that it'd be great to be able to share with other countries. But there are things that stand in the way of that. One you've mentioned is the gas price, although, of course, you know the coal price has also shot up and is causing problems in China alongside some interesting policies that they've got. But it's not like coal is static. What I would say is that for these things to work, these international coalitions of the willing, which, as I alluded to earlier, are going to be so critical over the next few years, because we can't go at the speed that Saudi Arabia is prepared to let us go as a global community. There are going to be two things that really help make it happen. One is trust, and one is the technology race. And those two are slightly in tension, but you know they can be made to work profitably together. The technology race, I think, is probably well known to listeners of this, which is that. In certain sectors, and we're now seeing it in electric vehicles, there is a competition to get there first. It's starting to emerge around green hydrogen. Who's going to win the race? Who's going to get the jobs? Who's going to get the investment to provide that technology? But at the same time, if we're going to move as a coalition, of the willing and help and support those developing countries who might otherwise go down the coal route, then they have to be able to trust the technology and the finance. And that's why these coalitions also spark off what goes on within the coalitions, within the conference of the parties itself, where the text is being negotiated. And it comes back to, you know, is the $100 billion per year going to be provided? What sort of support is actually going to be provided within the UN framework? So these things don't sit separately. We can have these coalitions, they're brilliant. We do need to have a formal rule book, but there are interplays between them, and we have to get both bits right.
Okay. You've given me a lovely segue, Doug, into the thing that I was going to ask both of you about next. And that is to kind of pull the focus away from these kind of coalition building activities, which seem to me to be extremely interesting, very, very laudable, but to the actual negotiations themselves. So I've got some facts in front of me. 197 parties to the UNFCCC Accord. There's a range of topics that the actual negotiations will be focusing on, around carbon markets, as you've said, financial flows, reporting adaptation, and so on. So what's the biggest challenge amongst all of those things? And why don't you answer first? Give me your view on the biggest challenge.
I think the biggest challenge is going to be the rules around what are known as Article 6. And apologies for some slight geek speak here, but when the Paris Agreement was signed off in 2015, came to force 2016, there were some provisions, some articles which were supposed to be further developed into a set of rules. And one of these was Article 6, which is about joint delivery of emissions reductions. Now, that's been widely interpreted to be about carbon markets. It shouldn't just be about carbon markets at all. Joint delivery can be about finance, technology sharing, capacity building, and all sorts of other things. But it's been widely interpreted as carbon markets. Now, unfortunately, carbon markets bears a very close resemblance to its to what I would describe as an evil twin called offsetting. And offsets are stereotypically, not exclusively, but stereotypically, they are where a developed country, or more often a developed country company, pays someone in a developing country to plant trees or do something for nature. And that is a highly controversial process. It's been tried before and worked very poorly. But there are a number of nations who are pushing very hard for that to happen because they see it as a bit of a money spinner. There are also quite a number of developed countries who also see it as a kind of fairly cheap way of not doing a great deal to change what their existing models of how they operate. So it works as a bargain, but is actually very problematic because history shows they often don't work. There's a limit to how much can be done just because there isn't that much land. As Mark Twain said about land, they're just not making it anymore. Very often there are potential for impacting on indigenous communities and indigenous peoples in the process of trying to convert land to be in a better state for preserving carbon. So that's going to be the most controversial aspect of the negotiations, I think, because it's fraught with difficulty.
So I've heard about this mythical Article 6. I'm never quite sure I've understood it, but from what you've said, it's about the kind of joint the ability of companies, countries rather, to actually agree to a shared target, and then how they might trade or otherwise negotiate who does what. And I certainly remember the climate negotiations 10 years ago or so, very much been focused on this kind of preoccupation about transfers between the rich and the poor, or the north and the south, and all of the kind of fairness issues around that. So, Simon, are you going to be able to fix this? Not, I mean, I don't know personally, but is the UK going to be able to get this Article 6 thing resolved?
Definitely not personally, and it's not the bit that I ever see. So I was very glad that you asked Doug to explain it first. But collectively, as the presidency and with the goodwill of the other countries, then yes, we very much hope so. Because going back to a point that I think you raised and Doug responded to about trust, the negotiations do play a really important role in building trust and building consensus, building mutual confidence between countries. And that's what the Paris Agreement did in really quite an outstanding way. And so this issue now of Article 6, it might look very technical, and it is very technical, but it's something that needs to be agreed to maintain that sense of confidence and forward movement. So I think most of the countries will be coming to Glasgow with a willingness to resolve that, recognizing that we didn't manage last time round at COP25. So, yes, we'll do our best. And I think that the interest for us, Doug quite rightly spelt out some of the problems to do with that Article 6. We'll be trying to reach a compromise, a consensus agreement that is fair and that maintains integrity of how emissions are accounted for in the global system.
All right. So I'm just trying to try and figure out. So if you think about the past, you remember the big negotiation at Copenhagen where everybody was in tears, and then the big negotiation in Paris where everybody was cuddling each other and singing and tears of joy. So how do we make this more like Paris? What needs to do? Maybe that's a difficult question to answer, but it seems to turn around some of these quite complex things like Article 6. I mean, being very cynical, do we just have to fudge them in order to get everybody on board? Is that what it will end up being? I'll ask Doug, and then it gives Simon a chance to think of an answer.
Well, I think I think the question how we make it more like Paris than about Copenhagen actually sits to some extent in the past, because it's about the nature of bigger geopolitical issues that do come to bear on the negotiations like this. And at the moment, the augurs are not as great as they could be. They don't look like Copenhagen, but they certainly don't look like Paris. And the COP presidency can only sort of make use of what it's got to work with. The big things that need to happen, it seems to me, are it's vital that we actually live up to one of the things that was agreed in Copenhagen, which is that there would be $100 billion of financing per year flowing from developed to developing countries to help them with adaptation and with mitigation of climate emissions. But obviously the adaptation, if you're in a low-lying island state, you know, you're already thinking adaptation is where we're at. It's not just about mitigation. And if that money doesn't come forward, I think the loss of trust is going to be very serious. I'm not going to say it's going to be terminal, because it's clearly not going to be terminal, but it'll be very damaging. And incidentally, that's why the aid cut, the international aid cut in the UK, was also so problematic. It does undermine that sense in which the UK, as president of the climate talks, is kind of rooting for the developing countries who are most on the front line of all this stuff.
I'm conscious that we could talk about many of these things for a long period of time. And I want to, before we end, I want to take us across to the domestic agenda. You've mentioned the UK leadership role, but Simon, so making everyone, you know, clap and sing at the end is mainly down to money. Is that fair?
Well, I completely agree with Doug about the importance of the 100 billion for trust. And I think the COP president, Alok Sharma, has been incredibly clear about that. And the UK is making a really serious contribution towards that ourselves, £11.6 billion over the next 5 years. And we've been lobbying other countries really strongly to do their bit as well and make sure that promise is met. But to answer your question more generally, if I can just put it in the long-term perspective, we had the first 20 years or so of climate change negotiations where the idea was we'll try and agree how to divide up the global carbon budget. You know, we'll say if we're trying to avoid dangerous climate change, then we can only emit so much. So all of us, all the countries need to agree exactly how much we're going to emit. And that's what we all tried to do all the way up until Copenhagen, when really that attempt just eventually fell over and people realized it couldn't be done. And then with the Paris Agreement, we had the emergence of a new approach, which said, let's agree on some collective goals and then each individually do what we can as a contribution towards meeting that. So we agreed the collective goals of aiming to limit temperature rise well below 2 degrees and below 1.5 if we can, and the collective goal of balancing global emissions and sources and sinks of emissions, in other words, global net zero in the second half of this century. So those were all collective goals. Now, I think there are two things that can come out of COP26 that may not have everyone dancing on tables, but might make us feel, well, we've kept those goals within reach and we have grounds for hope. One is countries aligning their national goals with those collective global goals. So if you want to see global net zero emissions, you need to have national net zero emissions. And as many of those as possible need to be around about 2050. And actually, there's huge progress on that now. There's about 3/4 of global GDP covered by net zero 2050 goals. Of course, that's not much help if your goals in between are going up steeply. So countries need to align their 2030 emissions targets with their 2050 net zero ones. So that's one thing. The second thing, going back to where we started, really, is if there are groups, a critical mass of countries in each of the emitting sectors saying, we're going to work together seriously to support each other, to shift global markets, to gain greater economies of scale, to put in place level playing fields where we need them, to accelerate innovation, mobilize investment together, then that is really a new start. We've not had that so far. We've not had serious, sustained collaboration in each of the emitting sectors. And if we can have that coming out of COP26, that, I think, would be a real reason for celebration.
Okay. That sounds encouraging and underscores the approach that you've been taking, your strategy, if you like, with these sort of sectoral themes. In the last few minutes, I'm gonna drag us away from the international and back towards the domestic. Prior to recording, just this same week as we're recording, the British government unveiled its net zero strategy, bringing together a bunch of strategies for the various emitting sectors, actually, and making all sorts of plans and commitments. You might finally disagree with one another a bit on this one. So, Doug, what does Greenpeace have to say? Is the UK really walking the talk?
Well, not as well as it should do. I mean, look, there are two standards one can apply to how well is a country doing. And one is to say, well, how well are we doing compared to other nations? And on that basis, you think, well, the UK's doing all right. And the other one is, well, how well are we doing against what we need to do, against, if you like, what the science is telling us we need to? And that's where it all falls apart a bit. It's not because the targets aren't there, because actually the UK's got some quite decent targets in a range of places now. I mean, they could be better, but, you know, they're decent. The question is whether they are going to be delivered on. And that's when the policy starts getting crunchy. So there are a couple of things about the whole approach that I think are problematic. I mean, we can go through the individual sectors and say, well, what's wrong with power? What's wrong with transport policy? What's wrong with buildings policy? But one thing I would say is that, well, so there the first thing is there is an obsession with technological change as the route to delivery. And that I think the quote from the Prime Minister to the words to the effect of nobody's going to have to change their lifestyle in order to deliver on the outcomes here. Well, I just don't think that's true. He's just wrong about that. I don't think there's any prospect that the sort of changes that we need to make in the timescale that's available can be achieved simply by everybody still being able to do exactly as they want on high carbon lifestyles. The other thing that we've started to see within government is the splits between those who are willing to basically spend money to save the planet, as we see these an increasing number of extreme weather events, even at the 1.1 degree centigrade temperature rise that we've got, and those who are still prioritizing, if you like, fiscal discipline. And both of those act to undermine the policy agendas in the different aspects of actual kind of the gritty energy and climate policy across the sectors, whether it's in transport or buildings or whatever. And it's those two fixations that I think are potentially going to be problematic and a long-running theme about why it's going to be difficult for our government with its current approach to deliver on what we need to do to hit those targets, which, as I say, are not necessarily bad targets, but it's hard, hitting them is going to be tough.
All right, Doug. So yes, I think the Prime Minister pronounced that, you know, he certainly doesn't like hair shirts. He dislikes hair shirts almost as much as he enjoys cake, I think. And certainly some of the more behavioural provisions were that the Committee on Climate Change recommended were pulled, weren't they? So there's nothing about eating less meat, for example, yeah, which seems like a pretty painless thing to me, or flying less, which I must admit I might even struggle with sometimes myself. But there's this kind of, you know, between number 10 and the Treasury, it seems to me, Doug's alluding to a bit of attention there. Simon, a loyal civil servant, I'm sure that I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no problem. I mean, I think everybody recognises that the low carbon transition, the transition to net zero, it's a huge economic opportunity, but it's also a difficult thing. There are a lot of difficult policy reforms that have to be made, a lot of interests at stake, a lot of change that is involved, structural economic change. That's not easy to do, and it's not easy to do at pace. To pick up a few of the things Doug mentioned, one point I would make is about uncertainty. And I think this relates to the question about technological change versus behavioral change. Often we're quite bad at knowing how fast things can move. And one example of this is global deployment of solar photovoltaics. Back in 2006, experts projected that by 2020, we'd have 50 gigawatts of solar deployed globally. When we got to 2020, we found it was over 600 gigawatts, more than 10 times as much as we expected. So we were wrong by an order of magnitude, and it was a good surprise, not a bad surprise. So technology can do more than we sometimes expect. In the power sector, of course, we've had the world's fastest decarbonisation in the UK. And on the whole, consumers haven't really noticed. Bills have come down quite significantly through energy efficiency, which has managed to offset the increases of subsidies for renewable power. So we haven't had to change our behaviour there. Of course, some other sectors are much more difficult, and that may not be the same. You mentioned food, which is one that's often talked about in relation to behavior change. I think there's a real uncertainty there about whether in the future we'll have to eat less meat or whether we're able to eat meat substitutes from plants or synthetic proteins that actually taste exactly the same. I'm hoping that I will still be able to eat something that tastes like a burger, but doesn't need to grow a cow to bring it to my plate. Flying the same, people often talk about the need to fly less, but electric planes are being developed very quickly, and there's sustainable aviation fuel as well. So I think there are unknowns there. The other point I'd pick up is about spending money. Spending money is important, but it's not the only way to get things done. And I think one of the most interesting new policies in the net zero strategy is a ZEV mandate. That's a zero emission vehicle mandate, which is a form of regulation that says to manufacturers, if you want to sell cars in our market, then this many of them, this proportion of them must be zero emission vehicles by this date. And that's a really great policy. We've seen it really effective in California and in parts of Canada. When you put that in place, it makes it the job of the industry to shift their investment into the zero emission models. And so you do it through the reallocation of industrial capital. It's not all about public spending.
Clearly, we need to come back to many of these topics. Doug, I'd be delighted to get you back to talk about behavior change versus technology, for example. And obviously, technology progress doesn't come without great, you know, effort on the part of policymakers. Solar didn't get cheap by itself. Solar got cheap because a few countries took a lead in promoting it as a promising technology. But that does leave me really excited for the COP. The COP show when it starts in a week or two time, and we'll certainly come back to these issues once we've seen how COP concludes, and maybe try and hold somebody from UK government feet to the fire over delivering on the various goals and aspirations. So it's just falls to me now just to thank Doug Parr from Greenpeace and Simon Sharp from the UK government COP unit. And you've been listening to the UKIRC Talking Energy podcast.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKIRC, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.